Welcome to History Here and Now. I'm Thomas, the voice inside your podcast machine, and today's topic is a special one. Because not only is it about a group of intrepid veterans in World War II Pacific Theater, but it also has a personal connection for me because my grandfather was one amongst them. Now, the History Here and Now podcast is dedicated to bringing you great stories from the past, and here we talk about people, places, events, culture, and practically every other facet involved with history. Now, does it sound complicated? Well, history is just that, complicated, but it doesn't have to be. I'm here to help break things down and make history more fun and relatable, so let's get started. Now, today's topic is going to be not only about the movements of one particular veteran during World War II, but also this is a topic that's been brewing around for a long time with me personally because it's about my grandfather's service. And my grandfather himself never really talked a lot about it himself because, you know, for whether reasons or not, he didn't want to get into sharing any gory details with any of the grandchildren. But, you know, he always left it there as almost an air of mystery about what exactly did he do? What was he doing over there? We knew he, you know, fought in the war, but beyond that, there wasn't really much else. I mean, it was only after his passing in 2005 that I really started to uncover more about his military service. And after my grandma's passing, and now even to this present day, I'm still learning more about what he accomplished during that time. Now, for as long as I can remember, hearing stories about his World War II service was, just as I said, part of my childhood. They were my first history lessons outside of school, and I spent many weekends and holidays with the two of them. You know, and a lot of time I heard about older relatives talking about his service in the Philippines or Japan, or just casually talking about the war. Now, hidden at the top of one of Grandma's big bookshelves was this really thickly bound brown book with large white lettering on it called Warpath, showing a Native American wearing a war chief's headdress. It was a chronicle of the 345th Bombardment Group, which was part of the 5th Air Force stationed in the Philippines during World War II. And this whole book talked about their achievements in the South Pacific. On many occasions, I grabbed it off the shelf and thumbed through the pages looking for Grandpa's face. Because instantly, hey, if I could pick him out, then I know that he was in the war. I knew which unit he was with, you know, when I found the respective sections. There was no headshot or group photos. But family lore did say there was one photo of him being taken from behind, showing this man rushing out onto the airstrip with his hat bill flipped up like Gomer Pyle, you know, from the old Andy Griffith show. You know, of course, that would totally be in his character. He very rarely shared personal stories about the war for a long time. And of course, when people would ask about it, you know, whether from school projects or friends or work, I'd always say, well, he served in the Pacific and he flew in these bombers in the Philippines. And that's all I knew. Now, when he passed away, and that was when I began learning more, he received medals he never mentioned before. And then there was this cache of old photos and documents filling in the gaps. And that really, to me, when you as a person learn about someone's military service, and especially if it's a family member, and you go out learning more and more about what they accomplished, it's really quite satisfying, you know, almost doing like detective work. You're putting all these pieces together like a giant puzzle, and then it all fits together and you see this grand picture. And it's satisfying to see the completed work. Now, since I started my career for the National Archives, it stirred my history passions learning about military records. Now, of course, like everyone else during COVID at the beginning of 2020, you know, everyone started picking up, you know, all these different hobbies since they would be quarantined at home. Now, I spent that time putting together a narrative of Grandpa's service, which I'm talking about here today. An unexpected miracle happened when in a vain attempt to find his discharge documents, which were destroyed in a fire at the National Personnel Records Center in 1973, I found this discharge document, which finally gave me some hard proof. I randomly placed a call to the Garfield County Records Office in Oklahoma asking if they had anything. And to my surprise, they did. Now, returning World War II veterans back at the time normally filed a copy of their discharge documents with the county in order to receive things like VA benefits or state and local benefits as well. Now, thankfully, his was still intact, and that flushed out the narrative even more. His war record is here, and the best that I have researched with all the available materials, things like group records from the 345th, and his particular squadron, the 499th Bomb Squadron, colloquially called as the Bats Out of Hell. Now, while some information will be lost forever because of the 73 fire, now this is an obstacle that faces all military historians and genealogy researchers, but every little bit helps. Now, diving into the personal history of my grandpa, Fred Laverne Richardson. Technical Sergeant Fred Laverne Richardson served in the U.S. Army Air Force from July 20, 1943 to January 14, 1946. Now, throughout his World War II service, he served with only the 499th Bomb Squadron under the 345th Bomber Group in the 5th Bomber Command with the 5th Air Force while overseas. And first, I only heard about the story that he was in the Philippines, but he was in Biak off New Guinea, and eventually Aishima, one of the Japanese home islands in the Okinawa chain. He participated in aerial combat operations throughout the South Pacific, the Sea of Japan, and a couple handful of missions over Southeast Asia and mainland China. At the end, Fred took part in a handful of battles over the Pacific theater and the American occupation of Japan. He was twice decorated with the Air Medal for his heroic achievements in aerial flight, and received multiple awards for his part in the liberation of the Philippine Islands. Now, researching World War II-era service records presents a unique challenge because a significant number of records were destroyed in a massive fire. Approximately 80% of Army records from 1912 to 1960 at the NPRC were affected with varying degrees of damage. Now, Fred's record was substantially damaged by the fire, and only a handful of documents survive, including some of the ones that I personally have. He was born April 26, 1925, in Enid, Oklahoma, to Fred L. Richardson, not Junior though, and Millie Pearl LeGrand. They lived at 508 North 9th Street, and Fred was a senior in Enid High School when he registered for the draft. Local Board Number 1 in Garfield County recorded his entry on the day after his 18th birthday, which means that only sometime later, in June of 1943, he got a draft notice. He's ordered to report to Oklahoma City, where he was formally inducted into the U.S. Army on July 20, 1943. Now, during World War II, inductees were required to serve for the duration of the war, plus 6 months, and this meant for as long as the war went on, he would remain in the Army unless he was dishonorably discharged, wounded, or killed. Now, following induction, he was transferred to the Enlisted Reserve Corps and was placed on active duty on August 3, 1943. Now, according to the family history, he completed his basic training at Amarillo Army Airfield in Amarillo, Texas. There's even this story that was told at his funeral that his family, of course, dealing with the fallout from the Great, still dealing with the economic pressures of the Great Depression of the 1930s, could barely even afford the bus fare to send him back, so he actually had to hitchhike back to basic training, and it was lucky that he made it on time. Now, aerial defense, air artillery, and forward observing courses were taught at Amarillo, and if Fred was later assigned to an Army Air Force unit, he received his physical and aerial warfare training there. Airfield trained recruits on B-17 Flying Fortresses, and these were the large four-engine long-range bombers capable of flying hundreds of miles, dropping thousands of pounds of bombs individually. Aerial combat training was tremendously harsh at that time, and only a very small percentage actually completed the physical battery. And of course, Fred, having grown up, in rural Oklahoma, he spent a lot of his time outdoors, and so I'm not really surprised that he was able to pass the physical battery with ease. Those who went on to fly education and armament training, in his recently discovered discharge document, he actually ended up attending two different service schools, aircraft armament training in Lowry Field, Colorado, and aerial gunnery training in Fort Myer, Florida. Now, one family story is that his aerial gunner training consisted of shooting skeets with shotguns out of the back of a moving truck. He said they would have to stand up, they would clamp their feet down, and as someone would shoot skeet out, the truck driver would cut these massive donuts and erratic patterns, you know, through the dunes. And of course, you know, when you're flying in a plane, your target is moving just as you're moving. And so having to complete that kind of course, I can't even imagine the difficulty that was there. Now, enlisted men didn't serve as pilots, though. Those had to be commissioned officers. So like pilots, navigators, or bombardiers, but gunners could be enlisted men. He completed all of his training by my estimate, had to be by July of 1944. Now, family photographs taken before he was shipping out, he received his assignment to the 5th Air Force and was promoted to the rank of corporal. Now, the separation document lists his military occupational specialty, or MOS, airplane armorer gunner. And this had confirmed my complete, you know, notion, everything they'd said, that he was a gunner on a bomber. And there it was right there, that proof, his MOS. Now, job duties included inspecting, repairing, and maintaining all aircraft armament, including bomb release mechanisms, airplane cannons, machine guns, and auxiliary equipment. You know, you had to make daily inspections, repairing equipment, bomb racks, releases, aerial sites, flare racks. You had to install armament equipment, you know, reloading, ammunition, and to serve in and to serve and actually man a machine gun during combat. Now, the rest of the family story says that while he was originally ordered to report to the European theater while in New York, his orders changed and he was transferred to the 345th Bomb Group. He was sent to Camp Stoneman near San Francisco, and this was a staging area for servicemen joining units in the Pacific. October 17, 1944, Corporal Richardson departed the United States. By the autumn of 44, which my estimate is in November, early November, so he had actually made it to New Guinea at that time. But also during this time, by the autumn of 44, the U.S. had pushed the Imperial Japanese Army and Navy out of the Southern Pacific and prepping for the liberation of the Philippines. Now, the Philippines, for context, had been under Japanese occupation since May of 1942 after the Battle of Bataan. Invasion plans had been in the works since 43, but they had to take all these outlying territories first. Now, air warfare at the time had changed drastically since the First World War. They made massive technological advancements, creating larger and faster planes. Long and medium-range bombers were able to deal tremendous damage. And the B-25, which Fred would work on, debuted in 41 and was eager to be used in combat. A medium-range bomber with 12 50-caliber machine guns, 75-millimeter cannon, 3,000-pound carrying capacity of bombs and incendiaries. This was one of the most versatile bombers in the entire war. Now, to give a little bit of bomber background history, on November 11th, 1942, the 345th Bomb Group was activated under the 3rd Air Force and trained in April 43 when they got their orders to report to the South Pacific and began operations in New Guinea of June of 43. So much took place with Fred's time in the Pacific. Now, their actions from the 345th and the 499th, they performed recon missions, dropping supplies, attacking Japanese ships through the Bismarck Sea, preventing serious threats to Australia. In April 43 and July 44, they relentlessly attacked Japanese garrisons and ships running through the sea. Their triple approach of high-level bombing, heavy machine gun strafing, and skipper bombing was effective in breaking Japanese control and opening the way for the liberation of the Philippines. Now, their time in New Guinea and Biak is when my grandfather enters the story. Biak was the next step in the unit's path, and after taking the island, could run missions over larger, closer to the Philippines. Mission after mission, the 345th lost hundreds of crews and bombers as they were shot down by Japanese fighter planes or hit by flak by enemy ships. During the Battle of Leyte Gulf, a kamikaze even hit a group of 345th personnel stationed on the ground before they can get airborne. Now, beginning of 45, the 345th bomb group started missions as far north as the Sea of Japan, destroying targets that were necessary for military planners as operations were drawn up for the long-anticipated invasion of the Japanese home islands. Both the United States and Japan knew that the cost in human lives would be astronomical, but intelligence analysts at the time estimated that casualty figures would easily reach into the millions as the Japanese military and civil defense organizations prepped for the invasion. Now, throughout the Pacific campaign, the 499th Squadron carried out its own specific missions. Now, since Fred had left on October 17th and arrived on November 23rd, he didn't take part in the initial Battle of Leyte Gulf, but his unit, stationed both from New Guinea and then in the Philippines, he spent the majority of his time on the Philippine Islands themselves. The 499th conducted operations between Biak and the Philippines, attacking shipping convoys, battleships, and actually engaging with the Japanese Air Force. Between December of 44 and July 45, Fred and his squadron flew from San Marcelo and Clark airfields, hitting targets all over the Philippines. The longest range mission that they ever carried out was an attack on Saigon in southern Vietnam in April 45. It was the most dangerous mission they ever undertook, but it earned them a presidential unit citation. Now, to divert a little bit, Fred never, ever talked about a specific mission. There's a story that went around in the family that he completed 42 missions, but no one was ever actually able to confirm that number. He never personally talked about it, but my dad remembers on a few occasions that, you know, Fred would talk about his service, that there would be times when his squadron was going in, and they would see just swarms of Japanese planes coming at them, sometimes clustered together so darkly they almost looked like smoke from far away. But as they got closer, he could see the large red pearls on the planes. And I can't even begin to understand or even comprehend just the adrenaline rush, but the fear that goes with trying to keep everyone on your plane alive by shooting down such a fast, dangerous target. Now, the Warpath book was interesting because it actually gives the stories of all these individual squadrons and their accomplishments. And one of them that I actually want to bring up in here was something that I know for a fact that Fred would have been involved in based on the time and his station with the squadron. It says on here, quote, "On February 18, 1945, the Apaches were called on for a 12-hour pounding of the Bagak Rogue north of Bataan, in support of our infantry in retaking the famous peninsula. The Bats Out of Hell flew two missions over the same target during that day. The entire length of the Bagak Road was sprayed with 50s and cratered with 500-pound bombs. The next day came a commendation from the commanding general of the infantry forces for the great support the Apaches had given them. It was stated that a total of 4,400 Jap dead were found in the target area. They had only to walk through and count the mangled bodies of the Japanese. The men of the 499th took pride in the fact that no infantrymen were lost in taking this objective. The operation was truly a magnificent tribute to air power. With the campaign in southern Luzon in its final stage, the men of the 345th turned their attention to enemy shipping along the China coast. These missions were the longest flown in group history, and in order to increase the range of our aircraft, further modifications were required," end quote. So, excuse me. Now, after spending a bulk of his time in the Philippines, by July of 1945, the 345th had advanced their position further north on the Okinawa Island chain and landing on Aishima. Aishima being one, you know, gaining notoriety as the place where Ernie Pyle was eventually killed while reporting from the front lines. On August 6th and 9th, when Hiroshima and Nagasaki were hit with the first atomic bombs. Emperor Hirohito later announced the surrender 6 days later on August 15th. And now the 345th received a different kind of orders. They were to escort Japanese emissaries for the formal surrender before General MacArthur. Three B-25s and fighter planes were ordered to escort the Japanese detachment to the Philippines, where they could begin discussing the terms of surrender and Allied occupation of Japan. Now, the escort was not without some hiccups, though. Hardline nationalists in the Japanese military wanted the escort shot down because tradition held that surrender was worse than death. And these fears were assuaged as the 345th mission formed a bracket around the Japanese planes and chaperoned them safely to Manila. Surviving airmen of the 345th, including Fred, remained stationed on Naishima until they received orders to rotate back to the United States. And on December 29, 1945, the unit was deactivated. Now, while in Naishima, Fred became part of the occupation force following the surrender. And we have this old family photo album that existed for years. And unfortunately, while we can't see if there was any writing on the back of them because they were glued in to every historian and genealogist's horror, so you can't see anything written on the back, the album contains some really unique photos. They were actually very small photos of what we could tell was the Japanese surrender delegation. The images, you know, of course, they're quite small, but when you see them through a magnifying glass, one can see the Japanese are wearing traditional garments presenting instruments of surrender. Unfortunately, there are no captions, like as previously stated, but judging from the content, many were taken in the Philippines and Naishima. Fred also, you know, enjoyed taking pictures of cultural landmarks and buildings and pictures of, you know, local civilians as well. So I think that's one of the things I appreciate a lot was that, you know, not only was Fred a soldier, he was also kind of a tourist. You know, he always, you know, he said he always loved interacting with the locals, talking to them, you know, even collected large amounts of foreign currency and army scrip. And he was actually surprised by all the different types of monies that would change hands in the Philippines. Now, between Fred's personal achievements and assignment with the 499th and the 345th, he received a substantial number of awards. Now, from what I have attained, this is most complete listing. He received the Aerial Gunner Badge, which was an aeronautical badge given to those who complete aerial gunner training or have the MOS as one. There were two general orders receiving the Air Medal, one for all of his meritorious achievements, both right after completing the surrender and during the occupation, received a second one. A good conduct medal, which is given to anyone who has 1 year of honorable service during wartime. His American campaign medal, given to those who spend 60 days stationed inside the continental United States. An Asiatic Pacific medal, which, you know, of course, goes without saying serving in the Pacific, but given all of the overlapping campaigns that occurred during the air war, he was given the most that I've ever seen with 8 campaign stars, which is a lot. Now, and of course, the World War II Victory Medal, given to anyone who serves, you know, during active duty during that time. And since he served in Aishima, part of the Japanese islands, by being stationed there after the surrender, he gets an Army of Occupation Medal. And he receives the Philippine Liberation Medal for taking part in the liberation of the Philippine Islands. He'd also received a presidential unit citation for the formerly mentioned raid on Saigon in Southeast Asia, which now remembering it, he used to make this joke that, hey, we were ordered to bomb Southeast Asia long before, you know, Lyndon Baines Johnson told us to. Of course, Vietnam War historians will understand that reference. And of course, all U.S. Army, Air Force, Navy, and Marine personnel honorably discharged received a special lapel button called the Ruptured Duck. Why it got this name, still haven't really figured out because it doesn't look like a duck, but it was basically informal proof that someone had served in the military and was honorably discharged and could be worn on their Class A uniform. Now, his separation document also showed that he received many He's received weapons marksmanship badges. Those who have served in armed forces will understand things like a marksman, sharpshooter, and expert, weapons badges. And he got one with a sharpshooter badge with a carbine bar. So I always knew Grandpa was a really good shot, but there's the actual proof right there. He returned to the United States on January 3rd, 1946, and was sent to Fort Leavenworth for separation. He didn't do anything bad. Everyone hears Fort Leavenworth as a prison. Yes, it still was then and still is now. But no, it was also a processing center for outgoing servicemen. The Army was demobilizing thousands of troops a week, sending them to various locations across the country to expedite the process. And of course, on January 14th of 46, he was honorably discharged for 2 years, 5 months, 25 days, which a year and 2 months of which was overseas. Now, the path he traveled took him probably many places a kid from Oklahoma would have never seen before in his life had it not been for a world war. He went across the United States, the entire width of the Pacific Ocean, foreign countries that, like I said, you know, some kid in rural Oklahoma may have probably never seen in his lifetime. You know, how do you go from living in a rural setting in the Midwest, all of a sudden you're now, you go from being in Colorado to Florida to New York to California, then to New Guinea, and then the Philippines, and then Japan, and then to Vancouver. And then, of course, coming back on the West Coast through Vancouver with this discharge, and then back through Kansas, and then finally back home. I mean, that's got to be a journey of a lifetime. And more amazingly, that he made it out alive, because tens of thousands of other servicemen didn't make it back alive. Now, 7 months after his discharge, he married Roberta Joy Davis on August 18, 1946, and began a career with the Frisco Railroad. But then on June 25, 2006, Fred Laverne Richardson died from natural causes at the age of 81. And 4 years later, Roberta joined him, and together they both completed well-finished lives. So a story like this, personal recollections of family members who have been veterans, who have served, understanding and preserving their history, their experiences is so vital. Me having the experience of a technician working with the National Personnel Records Center and learning all about these men and women's time fighting not only just the enemy, but also the elements and the psychological stress that comes with having to deal with, you know, the traumas of warfare. You know, I wouldn't be here today if, you know, of course, if Fred had been killed in action, but hearing his story makes me more grateful for everything that he had done. Now, I hope I really enjoyed that story. No, been on a hiatus for a while, but I'm here again. History Here and Now is a website dedicated to the research and writing about different historical topics. If you like this podcast, I hope really hope you, you know, share it on social media, recommend it to your friends and families and colleagues. You can follow History Here and Now on Twitter. You know, check back, you know, periodically for the next episode. And again, good luck. And we'll see you next time. Thank you for listening.